Hello and welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in the studio with me today is Diane Alston. She is Utah State University's extension entomologist, and we have a lot to talk about, and we hope that you'll join us in the conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there as well. Diane, thanks for coming in.
It's always fun, Brian. Thanks for inviting me.
So as I wandered around in my garden yesterday, there are always things that pop up. And I'm just going to start right off with this. I've noticed in my beans that there is the leaves are kind of going stippled and they kind of pucker up and they don't fold all the way open. Does that sound more like a disease or does it sound more like a mite?
It could be a number of things. We've had a lot of leaf curling in various vegetable crops this summer. Well, not just this summer, but you see it in the summer. And it's due to heat. Just the plant is not able to transpire fast enough to keep up with the amount of water loss because of the heat. And so, I don't know in the case of your beans if this could be a factor, but just be sure that you're irrigating well. And I know many people are on flood irrigation, and the downside, there's many downsides, but one of the big downsides is that you may only get it at certain times. And so you have a fairly long interval in between when you thoroughly flood the soil and it gets really dry in between. And that can be really hard on garden plants. They much prefer a smaller amount of water over, more frequently, such as you would deliver like in a drip system, for example. So that could be a factor.
So if I wanted to bring in a cutting of this, do I just take it to the extension office?
You have a couple of options if you're here in Cache County. Every county has the option of you can take samples into your local county extension office. And so every county in the state has a county extension office that's has USU employees that work there to help the public. And many of those counties run their own diagnostic clinics. And so oftentimes you can go online and type in your county, if you're in Salt Lake County Extension Office, and you'll get to their webpage and they'll advertise there what times and days are their diagnostic clinics. So that's one option. Another option is here on campus in Logan, we have the Utah Plant Pest Diagnostic Lab. And so we serve as a backup for all those county offices. So all the tough samples, the ones that are difficult to diagnose that may take some culturing of a fungus to be able to identify it, that kind of thing. Difficult insects, new insects, larval stages of insects people don't recognize, those can all be sent up here to Logan. But we do prefer that people go through their county extension office first, just because a lot of times they can handle it. They see it's a common issue, and they can tell you what it is right away.
Okay. Well, that's a great service that county extension offices provide. And as far as I know, there's only one county in the state that does not have an extension office.
That's Daggett.
And that's Daggett.
You're right. But they do, the surrounding counties service Daggett.
Yes.
And Daggett is teeny tiny, and it's a pretty high elevation. I don't think it's mostly like mountain cabins, not too many.
So they would go to Uinta County?
Yeah, I think they can go to Roosevelt or Vernal, both, okay. Whichever is closest to them.
One of the things that I wanted to make sure that we talked about, and this may take up quite a bit of our conversation, is about IPM, mm-hmm. or integrated pest management. And we have discussed it before, but it's been a little while. And there are just so many alternatives to using chemicals.
Right.
Now, integrated pest management doesn't mean that you don't use chemicals.
Right. Chemicals are one of the tools.
But there are a lot of other
tools.
Take a look at.
I think that's the key thing that you just hit on, that especially for the home gardener who may, especially if you're new to gardening or you haven't been involved in any kind of educational programs, you may not realize that there are lots and lots of options for managing pests and for keeping your crops healthy and in good condition and yielding good produce for you. And when we start talking about these things, people will say, oh, well, yeah, I know those things, because a lot of them are very common sense. They're a lot of our traditional farming crop management practices that have been used since the beginning of cultivation. But a lot of times we tend to forget about these things. I think in our modern culture, we think, you know, just like we want a quick fix. We want the people that are very electronically oriented and have to have the social media contacts. They want quick action. So people want a quick fix and they say, well, let me go to the store and buy a chemical that's going to kill this pest, this weed, this insect, this fungus, whatever it might be. And that will be that's my solution, versus thinking about the bigger picture of all the things that you can do before you get to that point of saying, well, I really do need a chemical to help solve this problem.
Well, one of the things that I think about in my garden are aphids, because mm-hmm. I usually have a ton of aphids. And one of the tools to use in IPM is just a strong spray of water.
Right.
And so about 3 weeks ago, I noticed that the woolly aphids were building up on my beech trees. That happens every single year. Some years are worse than others. Last year was terrible. So this year I thought, okay, Diane would say,
take your hose out.
A strong stream of water. So I've got one of those trigger handles mm-hmm. that shuts the water off until you squeeze the handle, and then it comes out. Mm-hmm. And I put it on its strongest stream, because these trees are now about 12, 13 feet tall. And it took me about 20 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And I've got three of the trees, and I went around each one just mm-hmm. spraying every square inch of the underside of the leaves that I could. And when I was looking yesterday, there's not a woolly aphid to be found.
Oh, that's great news to hear you had such good
success.
Yeah,
it worked really well.
Right. You had to work for it. I mean, it's not maybe some easy, but it was simple, and that you didn't need any expensive tools to do
but
it.
But if I had sprayed for them, I would have taken just as much time to spray and mix the chemicals, maybe even longer.
Right.
And I wasn't hurting the beneficial. Well, maybe there were a few lady beetles that were dislodged.
Right, but you probably didn't kill them, hopefully. You know, you may have killed a few, but if you'd sprayed some, you know, more toxic insecticide, you would have definitely killed them. So hopefully you spared the lady beetles, but you knocked those aphids off. And those aphids, they're not, for the most part, they don't have wings. And they're never going to be able to make, even if they're still alive on the ground, they cannot make that trip back up the trunk and get back on a leaf. So basically, they're done for.
I also did this same thing with, I wish I knew what kind of flower this was, but it's a yellow flower that dies back every year. It's herbaceous and then grows back. And it gets to be about 4 feet tall. And it's just covered with kind of almost aster-sized yellow flowers. Anyway, I noticed about a month ago, just tons of aphids right mm-hmm. underneath the buds, because that's when they were just about
to
getting
open.
Ready to open.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, no, you don't, and did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And first, I squished. Mm-hmm. I went to every single
that's a lot of work.
And squished, because I was so mad at them. But then I thought, okay, well, just get the water and spray.
Right.
And again, I look now, and there are no aphids on it.
Yeah, so that's a very useful tool, the one that you just physical removal. And for a lot of our plants, for soft-bodied insects like aphids, leafhoppers, for spider mites, the water technique can work really well. Another thing just to point out to keep in mind, so something you can even do before that is, we know that when we over-fertilize, that is put too much nitrogen, which as home gardeners, we kind of have a tendency to do. We think, you know, a little is good, so a lot's got to be better. And when you over-fertilize, so more nitrogen than's really needed, that makes the tree, the leaves of the tree or plant, very lush and high in protein content. That nitrogen is a kind of protein, or forms proteins. And so it allows insects a much higher quality food source. And so they are drawn to those over-fertilized plants. So you do need to fertilize your garden and your landscape. I don't want to say don't. But what I'm trying to say is just don't overdo it, because that can make them more susceptible, more attractive. So you've got to be careful with
because
that.
Because more is not necessarily better.
You need some. You need a balance. You got to have some fertility, or your plant is not going to grow as well. But you've got to keep it to a balanced level. And so that's something else to think about as you tend your garden, and as you put out fertilizer for different plants. Look, you know, don't just guess. Look it up. We've got fact sheets. We've now got a new Utah vegetable production and pest management guide online. Look it up. How much nitrogen do beans need? Beans are a legume. They're a nitrogen fixer. They really don't need any additional nitrogen. How much does corn need? Corn does need more, granted. How much does a beech tree need? You know, not too much, because it has a pretty good root system that can go down and harvest the nutrients in the soil. It might need some, especially when it's a young tree getting started. But look into these information and make sure you're fertilizing well, because that can be a big factor in keeping pests down in your garden.
So the insects are really looking for that lush new growth.
Exactly.
And if you've got too much nitrogen, that's exactly what you're going to get. And someone was telling me yesterday, my tomatoes won't ripen. And this year, I mean, in other years, I would say, well, they just have life too good. This year, I think maybe the cooler temperatures are kind of keeping things from ripening as well. But usually with tomatoes, I'll tell them, quit fertilizing and quit watering, because you're going to just create more problems.
Right.
Well, let's take a look at what IPM is and the different areas that we're looking at. So I was looking up online. Sometimes it gets maybe a little more detailed than I want. I'm like, record keeping, I don't want to keep records, but that might be part of it. Soil preparation. How would soil preparation help in IPM management?
So, for example, some of the pests that we get in the spring attacking our vegetables, they can be worse if the soil is not well drained, if it stays wet. For example, some of our maggots that might feed on the seeds and the young seedlings that are just getting started, like a real wet soil environment. So if you make a little more of a raised bed for your beans or cucumbers, for example, and you get that will actually warm up faster, so you get better growth of the germination of the seeds and growth of the seedlings, but also the water will drain better at that time of year when you aren't looking to, you don't want soils to be too wet, and you'll have less problems with some of the root maggots, flea beetle larvae, some of these other pests that do well in moist, a little bit cooler soils.
Now, I'm not necessarily advocating for or against till or no-till methods, but one thing about tilling is that you're not going to have as many grasshoppers.
Right. You will till up the overwintering stages in the soil. That's also helpful for flea beetles and other insects that are in the garden. So tillage can help to some extent. I understand if you want to try to have a low tillage system. But just be aware that if you're going to do no-till, you might want to consider some kind of a cover crop that's going to help protect the soil and be not conducive to buildup of pest problems.
What about planting? How does IPM work with planting? So are you looking at planting different
time periods can be, or how, and again, how you plant, seed spacing. Sometimes just even you realize there's going to be, like in a home garden, you're not a commercial grower. Your livelihood isn't dependent on your yield. So you're a little more, you should be hopefully a little more lax about things. So maybe plant a few extra seeds when you plant, because you realize that you're going to lose some of them to whether it's environmental stresses or pest stresses. But also time of planting is really important. You can escape big windows of pest activity by different times of planting. For example, with beans, Mexican bean beetle can be a common pest in the garden. And I found through experience over the years living here in Cache Valley that if I planted an early bean crop that actually kind of got well into the bean production stage before the Mexican bean beetles were even getting going, that I escaped that window. Alternatively, or in addition, I could also plant kind of a later bean crop and do the same thing. But it's that kind of mid-summer time. You know, if you've got beans in June and early July and mid-July, that's the time that the bean beetle is going to be the worst. So get an early crop and a late crop and avoid that mid-time. And you'll still have plenty of beans and you won't have to worry about Mexican bean beetle management.
Are you saying my laziness is actually paying off?
It can be a benefit, yes. That procrastination can be good sometimes.
That's what I did this year, and the beans are now vining. They're at the top of my trellis that I'm using, but when that's happened in the past, I don't usually get any bean beetle problems.
Yeah.
So with bean beetles, for instance, they only have the one generation?
They do,
Okay. So it's... that's where using your computer to get to know the insects,
right,
then you know exactly how to get around them.
Right. And, you know, people say, oh, it's just so overwhelming. There's so much to know. And so, especially when you're new to this, I say, well, pick a few things that are most important. Which crops in your garden do you know you have the worst problems with, pests or issues with? So pick those few to start with. Go online, get some information, get educated about some things you can do through the IPM approach, and then focus on those this year. And then next year you can add, you'll say, okay, I've got that down now. And the next year you can add a few more. And over time, you'll get to the point where you can use much fewer pesticides in your garden and still have a very successful yield.
Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and we're talking about insects today. And you can join our conversation. It's 1-800-826-1495. You can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment there, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Let's see, the next section of IPM that I'm looking at here, forecasting.
So this is where our advisories, which I know you talk about a lot on this program, where we tell you when it's time for different insects or pests, diseases to be active. And so what we do is we use weather forecasting to, so past temperatures, what's already happened, plus where we're looking to the future, to tell you when it's time to do different things. So one insect we talk a lot about on this program is the codling moth. This is the insect that attacks your apples and pears. And we know based on temperature, accumulated temperature, how fast that insect is developing. And it has multiple generations each year. For example, this year we're going to have a substantial third generation of codling moth along the bulk of the Wasatch Front. Here in Cache Valley, it's going to be quite small because we're later.
So even though the temperatures have been fairly, well, compared to the last couple of years, have been a little more mild.
Yes.
There's still going to be that third generation
but
for
when
everyone
you think
else.
About an insect, they deal with the full season. And do you remember what our February, March temperatures were like?
Okay, well, yeah,
they were warmer.
Warmer.
And so insects were already getting going, whereas in a cooler winter, late winter year, they're not. So
has there ever been a fourth generation?
Not in northern Utah, perhaps in our Dixie area.
Okay, so this would be using, and we've talked about this before, but there's a publication that can just be emailed to you at mm-hmm. appropriate times.
Mm-hmm.
And which one is this found?
So it's found in all of them, but for the tree fruit pests, like we're talking about with codling moth, that would be in the tree fruit pest advisory, but also in your vegetable and small fruit advisory. For example, the raspberry horntail, we have a degree day model that tells you when the raspberry horntail becomes active each year, so you know when to target, if you're going to use some insecticide sprays, when to do that. So really all of the advisories use this forecasting to help you better time your pest control activity so you get the most benefit from your actions.
And there is an easy address for this. Just go to utahpests.usu.edu. And I was able to click immediately on to going to the pest advisories, and you can sign up for a number of them. Just type in USU Pest Advisory for doing a Google search, and you just type in your email address, the county in the state that you're located, and if not in Utah, your state. So are there a lot of subscribers from out of state?
We get some, yeah. We have quite a few from the surrounding states, as you might expect, Nevada, yeah. Northern Arizona, but also we have quite a few from Idaho. I think especially for the tree fruit, even though they're a little milder than us and ahead of us in many ways, they still can use our information to help them better time their programs up there too.
So there's a landscape IPM advisory, small fruits and vegetables, tree fruits, turf, and Utah Pest News Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
That's one I don't think I've signed up for.
That's our newsletter. So that comes out each quarter. And so we try to do a little more in-depth analysis, just like UPR, NPR tries to give you a little more than just the soundbite and delve into some topics more in-depth. So for example, in this would have been the summer issue, right? We had an article about insect population outbreaks. Why do they occur? So it just gives you a little more understanding about about topics related to insects and plant pathogens in Utah.
And I'm now just signing up for it.
All right. Good job, Brian.
I got the other four. I'm like, well, why am I not getting this one? I should get it. So so the next section would be to talk about pest trapping.
Mm-hmm. So again, as part of those advisories, a lot of the information the benefits you receive when you sign up for those are that we have scouts out around the state. We have some that work with our Utah Integrated Pest Management Program, but we also have a lot of Master Gardener volunteers that run insect traps for us around the state in different areas, different counties. And so they can tell us when colleen moth first emerges in Utah County and in Weber County, for example. Or they can tell us, you know, and I'm out scouting in my landscape now, I'm seeing lots of, beach aphids. I'm seeing lots of different, you know, locust borers are starting to become active. I'm picking them up in my trap. So those are the kinds of things that then feed into our advisories, and we can help deliver then the information, timely information to our citizens.
And this is related to chemical control, but it also goes to the monitoring and the forecasting. So I've been using this forecast method to know when to spray my apple trees mm-hmm. for the coddling moth. I have sprayed once this year.
All right. How are they looking?
I've had a few. In fact, I usually wait until I start seeing just a few mm-hmm. Entry holes, pull those apples off, and then spray at that point. And boy, my gala is just looking really, really good. I mean, they're all looking great, but my gala's, it looks like a Christmas tree. They're starting to redden up, and they look really good. And I'm going to spray one more time mm-hmm. because I know, looking at the models, that I tend not to spray toward the beginning of the period, but mm-hmm. it when it's the greatest hatch
right.
period, because I can deal with a few.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, they're looking really good this year.
So compared to maybe the past or what you think you might have done, if you didn't have that advisory information, someone telling you when the colleen moth is at its peak egg hatch, how many times do you think you would spray?
Well, last year I didn't spray at all, and I had complete other devastation but I didn't have a lot of apples last
right.
year for various reasons.
So you decided not to, yeah.
Yeah, but if I had been spraying without having that information, I would probably be doing it every 10 days all throughout the summer,
right.
not knowing.
And that's a lot of sprays.
Yeah.
Versus a couple. So that's what these, you know, that's what all that forecasting, scouting, trapping, all that information comes together. And that really is the foundation of an integrated pest management approach, having that information to deliver the most accurate, timely information possible.
Now, I'll get into what I was spraying here a little bit later, but I wanted to move on to the next section. We have that we just talked a little bit about the monitoring. See, thresholds.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't apply to every example, but many of our pests, there are some thresholds. So as you just mentioned, well, I can take a few wormy apples and just pull them off, and I still have more than I can, you know, eat probably anyway. So we all have some different thresholds. So a lot of our information does give you some guidelines about, how many is too many. And but even within that, it's still kind of a personal choice. Some people, like I know, I have a lot of root weevil in my landscape on my lilacs. Those are the ones that notch the edges of the leaves, and I don't mind some of that. I'm not going to be one that's going to go out and spray for that because it just doesn't bother me that much. But there are some people I talk to that, I can't have any notching on any of the leaves in my landscape. It has to be picture perfect. Well, obviously their threshold is much lower, so they want to know when they should start treating. I say, well, as soon as you see that first notching starting, then you need to put on the spray for the root weevil. Whereas someone like me will probably not spray. Or if I had I might say, well, I'd wait until I saw, maybe 10% of the leaves with notching.
Now, for me, my threshold has been pretty high the last mm-hmm. couple of years. But this year I've noticed that it's the lilacs, it's the peony, it's my clematis. I've mm-hmm. never seen them on my clematis, and there's notching all over the clematis. So I'm thinking, well, maybe next
you need
year
you to do something.
I'm going to do put something on the soil and have mm-hmm. the plant take it up so I don't have to even worry about
There's a systemic insecticide called imidacloprid. that is effective on, because it's the larvae actually on the roots that really are causing the damage, so to speak, to the plant. The notching or the adult is the adult feeding. People may not like how that looks, but in terms of the health of the plant, the notching itself isn't causing much problem.
So how do you tell the difference between the root weevil and leafcutter bees?
Okay, it's a good question. The root weevil notching tends to be more oblong, so the cuts go in a little further, they're deeper, but narrower, and also a little more erratic or rough looking. They're not real even and smooth, whereas a leafcutter bee tends to cut a very circular piece of leaf, and so it's much more round and very uniform, very even edge, whereas the root weevil is not as careful of a chewer.
Now, that's funny. Now, the best way to tell is to go out at 10 o'clock at night with a flashlight,
right,
and then you're going to know right away. And that's how I know that's what I've got for sure, because
you'll see them
found
out
the
there,
little black buggers
out there feeding, doing the notching. And and you point out a good point with your, they're getting to a point now where I feel like I need to do something. And that's fine. And that's part of IPM too, that you have a threshold. And when there's just a little bit of notching, you say, that's fine with me. But now over the years, it's built up. And so maybe I need to come in and do something for this year. But then it'll probably be a while till you need to do something again. And so using those thresholds can really help you decide when it's time to do it.
Now, do the weevils tend to just be in the soil right by the plant they're having issues with?
They have a pretty broad plant range, as you just noted, that's not just lilacs. And you'll see them on strawberries. And we have a couple different species, actually. They're same genus, they're closely related. So they will be on multiple plants in your landscape. But generally, the ones where you see the adult notching, those are the ones where the larvae are the highest.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and we'd love to have your questions or comment. Toll-free number, 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and leave your question or comment there. And or zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and we're back with the second part of the program, and we have Diane Alston here for about another 15 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. And then also you can send us, did I already say the email question?
You did.
Okay. 1-800-826-1495. There we go.
Yeah. And please, if anybody's thinking about a question, go ahead and call. We'd love to hear from
you. Oh, we do have a question.
Good.
This is from Trevor. He said, what suggestions do you have for long-term control of slugs in the garden?
Okay. So this is kind of going back to some of those first things we talked about under an integrated pest management approach and how you manage the plant environment. So slugs and snails like a moist, damp environment. That's where they do well. So oftentimes we see problems with them in more shaded areas of the landscape or garden, where you've got a lot of ground cover, so a heavy vegetation that prevents the ground from drying out. Also, even mulches can, in general, we obviously promote mulches, especially here in a dry state. But if you're having excessive slug and snail problems, you may want to consider modifying that environment slightly to allow the soil, the area to dry out a little bit. I'm not talking about excessive drying, especially if you've got like a hostas or something that they love those, and because of they grow in that shady environment, and they have those very dark green lush leaves that slugs like so much. So you have to do it within reason. If you make it hot and dry, hosta's not going to grow there, but you won't have slug problems either. So anything you can do to modify the environment, open up the plant canopy sometimes. Maybe you've just got too dense of vegetation. Doing a little pruning and you know, opening up of the area can just allow better airflow, maybe not so heavy of a mulch to dry the soil a little bit. So those are the first step. Then beyond that, there's some things you can do with trapping.
And this goes into cultural control methods?
So that would be cultural control.
Okay, right? And that was our next section for IPM?
Yeah, so those would be things that you could do culturally to just reduce the favorability of the environment for the slugs.
So they're usually out feeding at night?
Mm-hmm.
So you could go out with a flashlight and just pick them off.
Right, you can do some mechanical, physical removal. Also, you can do some trapping. So you can buy commercial slug traps. You can make your own. There's different things you can put in slug traps. Some of the old traditionals are the cheapest beer you can buy that works well. You can make your own yeast solution. I've heard of other products that just home remedy products people have used.
So what kind of a trap? Build one for us.
So the commercial ones are pretty slick, and they have a top over them, just also keeps like your cats or dogs or something out of it as well. And it probably keeps evaporation down of the liquid bait. But it's just like a dish, basically like a low-sided dish where you would put the liquid bait in.
Do you have to set it into the soil or just set it on top of
either
the soil?
Either just right on top. Sometimes, just kind of push it down in a little bit so that it's not going to be sitting up above the surface too high. But you can just do this with low-sided dishes. I've seen people use jar lids, like big, large jar, like off of large mayonnaise jars and things like that, and use those. Because you have to refill them, pretty frequently. Especially if you're sprinkler irrigating, you're going to get water in them and it's going to dilute them.
So it's the yeast that's attracting
right,
them.
Right, right.
So they're not looking for a good foam.
No, not necessarily a head on your beer, but they're looking for that yeast, that fermentation is attractive to them. There's also
I'm sorry, maybe back up. Do they smell it? How do they know it's there?
Yeah, they do. They have sensory receptors that pick up the odor, and they like it, and they're drawn to it. And basically, when they crawl into the dish, I'm not sure that it's totally clear or known whether do they actually like drown or do they just imbibe of that, and it just kind of is too much for them. It's more than their system can handle, and they croak. There's also some commercial products, and one of the really nice ones, a low toxic one, is called iron phosphate, and Sluggo, and there's a number of different bait products that are just this iron phosphate little granules, and
it's
totally
pretty innocuous.
Very innocuous, just breaks down whatever doesn't get consumed by your snails. It's not harmful to other animals that you might have in your garden. It does break down fairly quickly, so you do have to reapply it.
Does it become chelated?
Every few days. That would be nice if it could be our iron source. I don't believe that happens, but it is a very innocuous thing that you can feel comfortable putting in places out in your yard and garden. And you do have to reapply it fairly frequently, but that's also a good slug control too.
Okay. Well, thank you for your question. That was Trevor, went to our Utah Public Radio Facebook page. You can also ask your question or send us a comment through the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, zestygarden@gmail.com or 1-800-826-1495. Nancy will be with us for about 8 more minutes. And I want to make sure we get all the way around. So we've been talking about cultural methods, and those are mechanical means, pretty much. Anything else included within that?
Well, anything you can do to modify the environment. So we were talking very earlier in the program when you were talking about your aphid issue about not over-fertilizing. So that's a cultural thing. Managing your fertilizer properly, managing your irrigation well.
Or spraying them like I did.
Spraying them physically. Putting down mulch or not mulching, depending on what the issues are. We were just talking about not over-mulching with the slugs. So those are all cultural practices that are best practices for your garden.
I want to use the vacuum cleaner because someone said they use this to get the squash bugs.
Mm-hmm.
I have great luck just going out and picking them off when they first start showing up, but there's just this little... Maybe it's a male thing about going out with a piece of equipment and sucking them all up. My wife probably wouldn't appreciate it very much.
You just have to think, be a little careful. You don't want to suck in your
the soil,
your soil, the plant, the leaves of the plant. But the challenge with squash bugs, as you well know, is they tend to be down at the base of the plant. And so even when people spray, if they just spray from the top, it's not really getting good coverage. You got to get down underneath. So that's where you need to physically remove them from as well.
So squash bug is a good place to be right now, because I saw in one of the publications, I'm not sure if it was July or the August one, that shows how to get rid of the eggs
right.
without having to squish them. And usually I'll just use my fingernail and squish
That's
them right on
too.
The leaf. And even though it shreds the leaf a little bit, it's still okay. But this showed using duct tape.
Right.
And you just put duct tape on it and
pull
off
them
they
off.
Come.
I mean, I always knew duct tape was for everything, but when Marion found that recommendation, I was like, wow.
It makes sense.
It's even for insects, too.
So let's talk about squash bugs, because I'm sure people are seeing them right now. If you leave them to develop on your zucchini is usually where they show up, but I've seen them on my pumpkins before as well. They can devastate
the
plant. They get into the tissue and suck all of the water out, and the plant one day looks great, and the next day it's all dead.
They actually feed right into the xylem vessels, which is where the water is transported in the plant. And squash, pumpkins have fairly large xylem, you know, those big stems, vines that they have, and they're loaded with xylem vessels. And the squash bugs, when they feed heavily, they're just puncturing so many holes in those that the plant at some point just can't maintain its turgor pressure, and it just wilts. And
so that's why a pumpkin might be able to make it, because mm-hmm. there's so many vines where that zucchini just has the one main stem.
So you've already alluded to some of the good IPM practices. When you first start to see the adult squash bugs come into your squash patch, they overwinter in the adult stage. So removing them when you look on the bottoms of the leaves, right where the veins come together and those little angles there, that's where they'll lay their eggs, and they're a bronze coppery color. So squishing, the duct tape method, anything you can do to manually remove those eggs, and then any nymphs and adults that you see to physically pick or squish. Those are all really good home garden methods to reduce their numbers.
I don't like getting them to the nymph stage, because they're much harder to get at that point.
They are.
So what I'll usually do is take over about a 2 to 3 week period, about every other day, I just look at the base of the plant, because that's, I don't know why they like to start
they
right
do,
at the very base,
like that
but
base.
That's where I find the adults. And then I just, when I see them, I just squish them. And usually I can get them at that point and avoid any eggs getting laid at all. But I will warn people, they are rather stinky.
They are.
They have a chemical in them that just like, blah. But I usually will take my glove and pick up is it a beetle?
No, it's a true bug.
It is a true bug. Okay, mm-hmm. So I take the bug and usually set it on the soil. They don't usually fly away readily, and I just have a rock handy and squish.
So you actually do the full squish. Another thing you can do is if you just have a little, like a yogurt container with some water, you can drown them too. Some people prefer the milder method of euthanasia.
Yeah, I like to do it quick, real quick, so I know they haven't suffered. I've kind of been that way my whole life, but they just... But not so much that I'm going to let them live. So I want to make sure I get my zucchini. All right. So cultural control. So the next section is, we've only got 2.5 minutes. So biological control and then chemical control.
Okay. So biologically, I advocate, let's use what we already have here, and they're adapted, they're naturally occurring here. And so how do we encourage the beneficial insects? It's by avoiding the highly toxic insecticides that we'll talk about just in just a moment. It's by encouraging diversity in your garden, having lots of flowering plants that provide pollen and nectar that are good food sources for the adult stages of these insects.
Or that deter them, like marigolds. That's why people plant marigolds.
Right. So diversity in your garden. Don't avoid large monocultures. So don't have, if you have 50 tomato plants, don't plant them all together in one place if possible. Try to break up little clusters of them throughout different areas of your garden. Have that diversity. That brings in the natural enemies. So that's really, that's all you have to do, and you should have some natural biological control. It's no rocket science, purchasing and releasing natural enemies is limited
well.
Success, really. If you're in a greenhouse, that's different, but outdoors, really not.
It sounds really good to go to the store and pick up this big bag of lady beetles to let go, but right. as I discovered the 1 year I tried it with these woolly aphids, mm-hmm. you know, I let them go at night, so they stayed in close to the tree, but by the next day, they had just
they
taken off for greener pastures.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're in a mode to want to disperse when you, after, because they've been chilled for a long time. So just encourage your natural ones. But let's get to the chemicals, because they are a part of IPM. So we were talking just about squash bug. There's a lot of low toxicity to people and pets and things. So Surround, it's a kaolin clay product. And so that can also be a good squash bug material. You do, it's a white, very powdery, chalky material. You need to put your spray nozzle right down there at the base of that plant and get the lower part of the vine and the undersides of the leaves. But that's a great material for deterring squash bugs and other insects. And it's not harmful at all. In fact, it's what's in old-fashioned chalky toothpaste and in kale pectate. That's kaolin clay. So it's a very safe thing to use. So chemical control doesn't necessarily mean it has to be harsh, toxic chemicals.
Well, and speaking earlier from when I said I sprayed my apple trees, I use spinosad.
Right.
And it's
a derivative from a bacteria.
And yep. It doesn't harm anything else other than those insects with chewing mouth parts, mm-hmm. which happen to be the caterpillar.
Right.
And that's what I want to get rid of.
And you hear us talk about insecticidal soap, horticultural mineral oil. Those are all these low toxicity types of things. And if you intervene soon enough and are diligent, you can use these softer chemicals and then not have to rely on what we might call the big guns, the things that are going to just kill everything.
Diane, we've reached the end of our time.
It goes so fast.
No, it does. And we had a great topic today. Thank you very much.
It was fun.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. And Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. Coming up next is Petals and Prose with Nancy Williams.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams. I'm here for Petals and Prose. And I want to share with you today from a book of essays called Riverwalking, Reflections on Moving Water by Kathleen Dean Moore. And Kathleen Dean Moore is a professor of philosophy at Oregon State University in Corvallis. She's written essays for the New York Times and for several other places. And this, I think, is her first book of essays. And she is writing about the natural world, which is what I love to read to you about. So hers are more located in Oregon in this case. And she usually titles them by a body of water. This one is called the Clackamas River. They came and got my neighbor this morning. I knew it was going to happen today, but I didn't know that they would move so fast. When I came home for lunch, it was obvious she was gone. The mailbox was standing open, for one thing, and even though the dog's leash was still tied to the porch railing, the dahlias were gone from the bucket by the front door, and the roller blinds were pulled down in the living room. Lillian would never have pulled down the blinds. She always drew the curtains. I had gone over to see Lillian before breakfast this morning. I knocked, pushed open the front door, and called out, "It's just Kathy," the way I always do. But the house smelled of cardboard boxes, not toast, and the living room walls were blank except for a row of clean white squares, each with a picture book centered at the top. A few things no one wanted still sat on the carpet, too good to throw away. The beaver-collared coat, a stack of sauce dishes, a gardenia in bloom. And next to them, Lillian sat bolt upright in a big chair, dry-eyed, her art collection propped against her knees. She wasn't going to go, she said. She wasn't as old as they thought. She had made up her mind, and she would not be bullied by her own son. And now she's 90 miles away in the West Hills Manor, probably sitting in that same yellow chair. So I stand now with a few neighbors who are gathered across the street, watching the empty house and talking quietly, urgently, as if the house had just burned down. I tell my neighbors I feel sorry for Lillian, and I really do, but the other person I feel sorry for is myself. What will I do without Lillian? Who will call each morning at 7 to say she can't unlock her front door, and will I send my husband over right away to shove on it? Who will notice my comings and goings and tell me that I work too hard? Who will tell our daughter to stand up straight? And who will measure herself against our son and say, "Is this Jonathan? He's so tall, I hardly recognize him." Lillian called at least 3 times a day in the week before she left, telling me to come right over. She had something for me. So now, instead of having Lillian, I have a Waterford crystal pitcher, a pair of gaudy shower thongs that she never wore because they looked like they were made for an old lady, a pen and ink sketch of the tree peony in her backyard, and a collection of gramophone recordings of Carmen Cavallaro playing songs like "In My Merry Oldsmobile." The records are heavy black plastic with a little hole in the center and grooves on one side only. I don't know what I'll do with them. Lillian said it was wild music, not what she likes, but maybe the young people would like it, not knowing that young people no longer have gramophones or phonographs or tape decks or even CD players sometimes. She gave me an egg cookbook that her daughter had written and one about cooking soup. I stood beside her while she sat at the desk in her library and thought about what to write on the title page. To Kathy from Lillian, who likes soup and Kathy. I stared hard at the ceiling to keep from crying, thinking what a rare and wonderful thing it is to be liked the way a person likes soup. Lillian made me feel young. "I thought you were a child," she would tell me. I said to myself, "Who is that child raking up the moor's leaves?" She made me feel competent and calm. Everything she asked me to do was easily within my abilities. Opening a medicine bottle, turning on a fan, disconnecting a garden hose. Except the last thing. I was not able to tell her son she wasn't going to go. I didn't even make the phone call because I couldn't figure out what was right and what was wrong. Lillian forced me to spend part of each day doing nothing. I would no sooner get home from work than she would call. "Can you use a banana? Well then, come right over. Never please, or is this a convenient time, just come over right away." So I would cross the street, walk up her front steps, knock, push open the front door, call out, "It's just Kathy," and then wait in the front hall for what would always happen next. Lillian closes the front door behind me, crosses through the dining room, stands in the center of the kitchen, and remembers it was bananas. Yes, bananas. So she picks up a banana and turns it over in her hands, as if it were a scientific specimen of a banana. Maybe she will put it in a bag for me. There should be a bag in that drawer. I choose a bag, but it isn't the right one. Oh, and could I use some gelatin salad? Somebody gave it to Mrs. Sartwell's sister, who gave it to Lillian, who never eats gelatin salad. So now, gelatin salad, what to put it in? Lillian, do you know what I could have accomplished in the time it took you to give me a banana? I could have emptied the dishwasher, changed Jonathan's orthodontist appointment, paid the electric bill, found Aaron's soccer ball, and returned a phone call from the dean. Everything and nothing. So I stood in Lillian's kitchen and became part of an old woman's life for a while until she thrust the banana at me and said, "You better go," as if I were keeping her from her work. Lillian kept track of our family. Each time we bumped out of the driveway pulling a boat, she came out onto her porch, stood with her hands on her hips, and said, "Now where are you going?" We would name a destination, and every time she would say in a softer voice, "I used to go canoeing on the Clackamas when I was young. We had picnics on the gravel bars. There were blue herons." "Yes," we'd say, "we remember you said so." Then we pulled out, and in the rearview mirror, her hands dropped off her hips and hung at her sides, and she watched us leave, witness to her own past disappearing around the arborvitae hedge, weekend after weekend. By now, almost all the old men in our neighborhood have died. The first to go was Mr. Jensen, whose house we occupy. Mr. Jensen of Jensen Hill, Ag Extension, Oregon State University, died sitting in a chair in our living room when it was his living room, and his daughter was at the theater. Mrs. Jensen moved into a nursing home and died there last year, after 12 long years, so now we send the mortgage checks to the daughter in San Francisco. But most of the women are still here, all widowed, of course, nursing friendships that are 70 years old, living in the gracious white houses where they raised their children, close by campus, where the sweet gum trees they planted are 40 feet tall and overhang the street. They came as students to Oregon State University when it was Oregon Agricultural College in 1922, arriving on the train from Portland with their dresses in a steamer trunk. Lillian was a tall girl with mannish hair and good posture, standing stiffly in the old photograph on her dresser in front of the girls' dorm. She married Walter, the dean of students. Mrs. Sartwell was a cheerleader, the same Mrs. Sartwell who doesn't get out much now except to water the geraniums on her front porch rail. Mrs. Wilson was the president of Alpha Chi Omega. She married the chairman of the food science department and had three children, and then she was president of the faculty wives. They all graduated from Oregon Agricultural College in the B curriculum, which meant no science required. I wish I knew what they have come to know. I wish I knew how they continue to live while layers of their lives are peeled away like successive layers of skin. How did they help each other live through the departure of all the children, leaving one by one, and then the deaths of their husbands dying one by one, a lottery of loneliness? When all the old people leave, young families will move into these wonderful old houses, and their children will buzz up and down on their big wheels, and we will give them cookies and show them pictures of our children, and we will be the old people in the neighborhood. Ultimately, my friends and I will all be widows and former things, former professors, former attorneys, former RNs, who were once married to former biology profs and political scientists. Our children will worry about us living alone, but will phone to say that it's hard to get away when you have a young family and a new job. For now, the old people are a bulwark against our own advancing age and uselessness. Lillian's house sold in 3 hours for a breathtaking amount of money, and her son never told her it was sold, even though she was still living in it as she had lived there for 58 years. It's a young couple moving in, an accounting professor and his wife, an agronomist. The crews come tomorrow to tear out the carpet and refinish the floors. Thanks for being with me. I'm Nancy Williams, a former professor. See you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.